Hi, welcome to another edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy, and it's great to have you here with us. Get a hold of me on Twitter at Ryan Ballingy. You can find Golf News Net on your favorite social media service at the handle Golf News Net. And find all of our work on our website, golfnewsnet.com, as well, the GNN radio app for your convenience. And you can download our channels for Roku and Amazon Fire TVs. We are presented by 2Under, and 2Under are the purveyors of, quote, asset management. We've talked about them to start the year, and we're working with them throughout the year to make you aware of the best performance underwear there is in the game, and maybe the best underwear you've ever worn, period. They have their original Joey pouch, which keeps your quote-unquote assets where they need to be, forward, dry, and happy throughout a round of golf or wherever you are. They have underwear that's perfect for golf, for the gym, for nighttime, for date time, for daytime. You name it, they've got an underwear that's going to perform for you, it's going to feel comfortable, won't chafe, and will make you feel like you're walking on air. So if you head over to 2under.com, the number 2UNDR.com, and use the promo code GNN20, you're going to get a 20% discount on your order on any of that great underwear that I just talked about, or their new awesome loungewear, their new t-shirts, socks, you name it. They have something that is going to make you feel comfortable and have a better day. And it starts with how you feel with your underwear, your undershirt, and your socks, the core of what you wear each and every day. So head over to 2under.com, number 2UNDR.com. Use that promo code GNN20 to save 20% off of each and every order. You are a fool not to take advantage of that. Also, head over to thegolfnewsnet.com/WorldAm. WorldAm. We're having our first ever GNN audience trip. It is in August to the Myrtle Beach World Amateur Handicap Championship, also known as the WorldAm. It is a fantastic event. You're going to get five rounds of golf for the price of four. You're going to save $100 on the entry fee, whether you stay with us or not. And if you choose to stay with us, we've got killer accommodations for you at the home of the world's largest 19th hole at the Sheraton, right next to the Myrtle Beach Convention Center. We're going to have a great week in our GNN comrade and friend Mitch Lawrence's hometown. We'll go out every night, have a good time, and see what the town that I love to go to two or three times a year has to offer in addition to world-class golf. So head over to thegolfnewsnet.com/WorldAm for more information. Okay, so this week on the show, we have a guest, and we'll have one next week too, at least one show. We might even do two. We're feeling so good about it. Anthony Pioppi joins us. He's going to join us in the second half of the show. We recorded the interview earlier in the week, and Anthony has written a book called Fine Nines. And it's a great, great book. It highlights the best nine-hole courses in the United States, and actually some in Canada, too. So most of North America, we're leaving out Mexico in the discussion. But basically, he outlines the 25 best nine-hole courses in the United States and Canada. And we talked with him about why he chose to write the book, the history of nine-hole courses, and then we got into a great discussion about architecture and why golf needs to make investments in itself and why cities should make investments and other municipalities and other governments that own golf courses should make investments in their courses to modernize them and maybe offer nine holes instead of 18 or 27, but to offer the best holes that they can. So great conversation we had earlier in the week. I hope you'll enjoy that. I wanted to talk a little bit about what we saw in Phoenix last week in the Phoenix Open and the annual party that is TPC Scottsdale hosting the PGA Tour event for Super Bowl Sunday. The Thunderbirds said they got almost 750,000 people there. They set a new record, wink, wink, like they do every year. They said Saturday was their most attended day ever. No matter what you think of the attendance figures, it was clear from people that were on the ground that there were more people there than they remembered from last year, which is certainly something to take in. And it seems like the surrounding rounds, like Saturday is always the biggest round at Phoenix in terms of turnout, because on Sunday, everyone's either A, hungover, or B, staying home to watch the Super Bowl. But beyond that, they had better attendance pretty much every other day, too. So it seems like the spectacle of the tournament is becoming a week-long deal. It's no longer just not that it wasn't ever just a one-day thing, but it feels like the interest has expanded. And I think that the folks behind the tournament, the Thunderbirds, have really come around this idea that we can do just more than one day. We can have more than one really fun day. In fact, all the days are fun leading up to Sunday, and then it's kind of all business because that's when the trophies go out. There were some reports, especially from both players and actually media, now that I'm thinking about it. George Savarikas from Golf Channel talked about this too, that some of the patrons at the 16th hole, and there's really only like 3,000 to 3,500 general admission seats in there. The rest of that space is all for skyboxes and corporate hospitality, and so you kind of got people who are corporately well-lubed and people who were here for like their bachelor party and got well-lubed. And they're different types of lubed up, don't get me wrong. But it, from the sounds of things, maybe the hole has taken a turn in terms of fan interaction, in that from the complaints were that it wasn't just good-natured razzing, it was deliberately pulling against somebody or getting on them in a personal way that wasn't funny, almost kind of taking it too far. And I think that's something that that was probably inevitable, right? I mean, something becomes so popular that the fringes get involved, and when the fringes get involved, if we've seen this in politics, when the fringes get involved, they can hijack something that people enjoy and make it miserable for everybody. That's exactly American politics right now. The fringes have it and make it miserable for everybody else. And that can happen in anything. That can happen at a golf tournament too. So I think there's going to have to be some kind of move from the folks at the Thunderbirds to try to make 16 as open as possible, as welcoming as possible to the number of fans that are there just for 16, basically, or to get slobber knocking drunk, but to not make it so distracting that the players themselves don't have a good experience. Because if you tick off the players, guess what? They're not coming back. They've got a lot of choices now, especially on the West Coast swing, which has seen a really nice resurgence, to say, okay, well, I don't want to get heckled. I don't want to have a bad time. I don't want to feel unsafe. Not that you would feel unsafe with a bunch of drunk people around behind ropes, but maybe you do. And maybe you don't come back. And if you don't come back, that means you bring the tournament down and you kind of say, okay, you guys win. The drunks win. The people who treat the players poorly win. And then all of a sudden it becomes a lesser event. And that is not something the Thunderbirds want. That's not something the PGA Tour wants. So it's going to be a weird balancing act. And the funny thing is, we have a really great field this week too at Pebble Beach for a 54-hole tournament, or a 72-hole tournament, 54 holes on three different courses, 156 pro-am teams, God forbid 6-hour rounds, but close to 6-hour rounds the first 3 days. And it is the complete opposite vibe of what's happened last week in Phoenix. A lot of wine drinking, a lot of cigars, a lot of leisurely walking, not a lot of laying down and questioning your life choices, rich people galore, really nice cars, completely different views, leading with architecture and good golf courses, at least in Monterey Peninsula and Pebble Beach. Sorry, Spyglass Hill, you got great views, but your golf course stinks. It's just not good. It's just hard and boring. So you have a completely different vibe, but that tournament is extremely healthy. It has come back. And part of that is having the right core guys there who are leading in the official world golf ranking and winning tournaments and trophies. You've got Dustin Johnson, who's going to play with his dad, or father-in-law, father-ish-law. You know, I don't know if they're married or not, but Wayne Gretzky. Jordan Spieth is an AT&T guy. He's going to be probably for the rest of his life, so he's playing there forever since they sponsor it. John Rahm has made a point to come to this tournament. You got Rory McIlroy for the first time this year. If it goes well, and playing with his dad should, then maybe he comes back year after year, just like he's going to probably do with Travelers, just playing it that one time. He's like, all right, yeah, I really liked it here. I'm gonna keep coming back. You got Phil Mickelson, obviously. So you got a good field. And you got in between Phil Mickelson at the bottom of the top 50 and those guys in the top three in the world who are in the field, a lot of great players. A lot of great they may not be the same name draw as those guys, but they're top 50 players. And the world ranking points that are available for this tournament have come up pretty significantly in the last 2 or 3 years. And you've seen the same thing in Phoenix. Again, they're completely different tournaments. There's no similarity. I mean, there really is not between the two, at least from what I see on TV and what I've heard from people who have been to both these tournaments. I've been to Myrtle Beach a couple of different times, or not Myrtle Beach, Pebble Beach a couple of different times and been fortunate to be there. One was for a U.S. Open in 2010. Obviously a completely different spectacle, different set of people, more or less. I've been there for the Pebble Beach Invitational Tournament in November, which is, again, a different vibe entirely. And I've been there when nothing's going on. So that's also a different vibe. But the sense that I get when you're there is it's just kind of peaceful. You're there just as much to appreciate what you can see beyond the players as the golf itself. And, you know, obviously don't really have that with a desert situation. It's just not what people think about when they think desert golf. They don't think, oh, the views forever. They think we're playing desert golf. And that's true in Vegas too, by the way. So I guess I'm wondering what's the common thread between the two when you see them? They're both stronger than they used to be. And I'm actually wondering if the involvement of the Tiger Woods Foundation at the Genesis Open, at Riviera, in the old LA Open, I wonder if that is something to do with it. Because if you're a certain type of player, you play Phoenix, especially if you may have struggled to get into other tournaments at the start of the year, and maybe you don't want to start out in Hawaii, and you don't want to be at the tournament at the Bob Hope, or now the Phil Mickelson, you know, in the California desert. You don't want to start in a pro-am type situation, so you start, and maybe Torrey's too hard, so you know, you decide, okay, I'm going to go to Phoenix to start my year. And then you say, okay, well, sure, I'll play Pebble Beach. It's Pebble Beach. You know, I don't mind. The rounds are long, but the networking is fantastic, and the views are incredible. I'll stay there. And then either of you choose one of those two, you go, okay, the next week is the Genesis Open. Riviera was really, I think, the tournament that started this resurgence by getting guys into a quality tournament and having Tiger's team involved. I think that elevates the status of a tournament. It seems to be run well, and for whatever reason, seems to have picked up some steam, and that means other tournaments benefit as well. So all of a sudden, the West Coast swing looks pretty good. Torrey had an okay field. It was great compared to having to contend with the Abu Dhabi event on the European Tour. So that's something to consider. So a relatively good start for the competing against the tournament that overpays players to come and compete well beyond the prize money. So that was pretty good. Career Builder was actually not bad, but then you still also have Phoenix, which is great. You've got this week at Pebble, which is back up, and you've got Genesis next week, which is going to be huge. So you've got an anchor tournament, I think, in Riviera that really helps steady the rest of the ship. Then you have this new, relatively new, one every four, or one in four, I should say, not one in every four, one in four PGA Tour rule that came along last year. The Travelers Championship was the big winner on that. And the rule, if you haven't heard it, is that if you don't have more than 20 PGA Tour wins, so basically if you're not a lifetime member of the PGA Tour, you need to play in a new tournament every year that you haven't played in the prior four seasons. And that means guys like Rory McIlroy have to go find a new thing to play that they hadn't played before. So this year it's Pebble Beach. Last year it was Travelers, and it worked for Travelers. They got him for this year. And so I think guys are considering trying to get that out of the way so they don't have to think about it later. Because if they do it early, then it's over with. Not to get it out as a chore, but to say, okay, if I need to shape my schedule a particular way based on how I'm playing, I don't have to have that in the back of my mind. I have to add a tournament. So I think that you're going to see these earlier season events start to become the beneficiaries of that. They're popular anyway, but you're going to get those kind of top 15 guys considering those events and maybe events that are after majors, you know, that are especially after the U.S. Open and after the PGA Championship, because they're relatively chill. They do a good job of accommodating players who have come off of a major championship, that grind of that week. So they're prepared to kind of pamper the players in a way that is fitting of what they've just gone through. So it'll be interesting to see, again, in year two of this, who picks what. And you'll know because they'll be like, hey, I never played that tournament before. So they're in. Speaking of which, this is for people in the Tampa area. So if you're not in Tampa, but I will be when this tournament's going on. So I'm kind of interested in this. Tiger Woods might play the Valspar. And he might play it because next week is Genesis. The following week would be Honda. That's his hometown tournament. But is Tiger in a place yet with his back where he feels confident enough to play back-to-back weeks? I don't know that he does. And if he doesn't, then Valspar is the following week, which means he could get in that rep, and then he could go to the Arnold Palmer Invitational. I don't know if that's going to happen or not, but I'm curious to see what does. We've tried to speculate about Tiger's schedule and included Honda in that, kind of presuming he would suck it up and do 2 weeks in a row on a coast-to-coast, playing on one coast, then coming back home. But we don't know. So I'm interested to find out if that's the case, and if it is, cool. I think that's going to be great for Tampa. That tournament has been rumored to be going to the fall portion of the schedule or moving to a worse date because of the realignment of the PGA Tour schedule that's coming next year. We don't know that. That's one of the rumored tournaments to move. So is Greenbrier is one of the ones that's rumored to move. There are a couple of others that are also out there like, hey, maybe this is going to move. But we'll see. And if that's the truth and Valspar is moving its date, then that would be a great last year in March if they get Tiger Woods. All right, so let's take a break and let's tell you about Health IQ. We've been working with Health IQ for a number of weeks now to start the year, and we love working with them because my personal experience in not only health insurance and life insurance, but financial products in a past life really comes together here with Health IQ. Health IQ is kind of like, for life insurance, what you do with car insurance. So when you shop for car insurance, you're shopping for the lowest rate, and you're getting discounts if you're a safe driver. If you don't have tickets and you don't have accidents, you get a lower rate. Well, Health IQ kind of does the same thing for life insurance. If you live a healthy lifestyle, if you are health conscious, if you're a runner, cyclist, you walk when you play golf, you're a strength trainer, you're a vegan, you have a gym membership, if you fit into a variety of number of categories, Health IQ can help you save anywhere between 4 and 33% on life insurance premiums. And they can do that because people who are physically active have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, a 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. So what Health IQ does is they work with top-rated, high-quality life insurance companies, and 70% of their exclusive rate clients get approved at that top rate class, which means you can get big savings on your term life insurance. You can get a higher value policy for about the same amount of money. And that means you have better protection for you and your family, which is extremely important. I cannot recommend enough having a good quality term life insurance policy. Head over to healthiq.com/19, healthiq.com/19 to learn more and see if you qualify. Check it out over there. You're going to find yourself immersed in a wealth of good information, and hopefully you'll be able to find a term life insurance policy that works for you and your family. Again, healthiq.com/19. All right, to our guest this week, first of the year, Anthony Pioppi joins us. He is the author of The Finest Nines, the best nine-hole golf courses in North America. And as I mentioned at the outset of the show, it's basically a ranking of the 25 best nine-hole golf courses in the United States. Now, we often, and we'll talk about this with Anthony when you'll hear the interview, we often confuse nine-hole golf courses with par three courses. And we think, okay, well, a nine-hole course is a bunch of par threes. They're just a bunch of short holes. That's not true. Best nine-hole golf courses in the United States offer threes, fours, and fives at varying lengths, just like an 18-hole golf course. They're masterfully designed. They have a great routing, a wonderful experience. They're often very reasonable to play, if not borderline cheap to play, and offer a great experience. Some of them are private, as we'll talk about in the piece. Most of them are public. And so I wanted to talk with Anthony not only about his book, but also about the history of nine-hole golf courses, where we're going with them, and hopefully maybe how they can be the future for our sport moving forward. So I hope you enjoy the conversation with Anthony Pioppi.
Anthony, thanks for being on the show with us. We're so great to be able to talk about your new book, Finest Nines. And I wanted to have you on the show in part because you're a great Twitter follow, but also because we've talked on this show a couple of different times over the last few years that one of the potential answers to helping golf move forward is the resurgence of nine-hole courses. And now I feel like we're in a place in golf where that's starting to take shape, that not only are we seeing the development of new par three courses and new short courses become a vogue thing for developers and for architects, but there's also an increased appreciation now for the great nine-hole courses around the country. What do you feel that's attributable to, and why do you think that you decided to choose to write this book?
Well, I think it's going to come down to the answer that we all pretty much feel it's that it's a time situation. People aren't playing 18 holes anymore for whatever reason. We can talk about those, whether it's slow play or they don't have enough. Even if you can play a 3.5 hour round, it's still a long, big part of your day if you're driving to and from the golf course. And so it's fitting into this niche where people still want to play golf. And now they're looking at nine holes, whether it be, the front or back nine of an 18-hole golf course or a nine-hole golf course, a standalone nine-hole golf course, as the answer to playing golf. I want to back up a second. I think what amazed me in all of this is how post-World War II, up until just about now, nine-hole golf courses were considered not genuine or not real golf courses. And I was baffled by that because I grew up in an area of the country in central Massachusetts where there's a variety of nine-hole golf courses around us. And I just grew up thinking, oh, that's a golf course. And it is a golf course. And I think for whatever reason, people again are realizing that a nine-hole golf course is nine holes. Part of it, I think, too, is that the USGA now allows you in the last few years to post nine-hole scores to get your handicap, and they never used to. I think that was a real knock on nine-hole golf courses.
If you kind of go down the list of courses that are featured in your book, there are 25 of them. A lot of them are in New England. I mean, they're spread out geographically. There are a bunch in Canada as well.
Right, right.
Why do you think nine-hole courses took so well and stand out so well in those parts of North America as opposed to maybe other parts of the country or in Canada?
So the game in America starts in New England, right? And it moves west, south and west. So early on in the history of the game, nine holes was a legitimate golf course. So as golf kind of exploded, people built required less land, but they built nine-hole golf courses because to them that was a legitimate number of holes. And so they weren't, although St. Andrews had, the old course had gone to 18 and that was what was considered, the standard 18 holes. They were looking at nine holes as being a legitimate golf course. And so that's what they built. A lot of what the greatest nine hole golf courses in the country were became 18 holes later on. Newport Country Club is a perfect example. That started off as nine holes. Shinnecock was nine holes. Myopia Hunt Club is the last course to host a U.S. Open as a nine-hole course. They started as nine and is expanding. A lot of these great courses just stayed as nine. And then the other answer to that is some of these courses were vacation courses where people would go to the coast, the wealthy would go to the coast to enjoy the summer leisure, and they did other things. They sailed and they swam and they sunbathed, and they golfed, and they played tennis. So they weren't looking for 18 holes. They were just looking for nine holes.
Yeah. That's actually a draw right to number 19 in your ranking, Gibson Island Club, which Gibson Island is a literal island just 5 minutes away from my great-grandfather's old house. And I almost took a job there. It was always my first job in golf. And I remember talking to the head superintendent. I was going to work on the grounds crew, and he spoke about the course, and I went through the whole shebang, and I didn't know it was a nine-hole course. And he said, we kind of go through all nine each day. And I was like, wait, there's not 18? And he kind of put it into perspective for me why the place was built. Gibson Island was meant, as you just detailed, for the wealthy as a getaway. And
right.
On the eastern shore of Maryland, now is kind of the beach country. That's where people go and have their vacations. But back at the turn of the century and even to mid-century, there wasn't a Chesapeake Bay Bridge to go over the Chesapeake Bay. So the Western Shore was where the rich went. And I feel like that kind of set the stage for a lot of things that happened in American golf, is where the wealthy congregated to have their leisure time. And I feel like that's why we have so many great short courses, because that's where the wealthy went. So why did some of them choose to be 18 versus 9? You know, kind of as you go down the coast, you get, and as you go west, obviously, we get more space and more courses. So why did nine-hole courses just kind of become more of the norm and become more of a share of what our total course inventory in this country is today?
Well, I think there was prior to, we'll talk about golden age of architecture, right, 1910 to the beginning of World War II, there was a lot of courses, more than there are now, more than you realize, I think the average person realizes, that were nine, that have since become 18. That nine was really latched onto as an acceptable number. I mean, Prairie Dunes, the great Perry Maxwell course, was nine holes. You know, there's a disagreement among the members of the club, and I've written about this course, about whether Perry Maxwell had ever designed the back nine, or whether that his son built the back nine. But was that Press's plans, or was it Perry's? But I've never seen plans where that was intended to be an 18-hole golf course. It was perfectly legitimate, you know, at that time to build nine holes. And it was only later that they were expanded upon.
It feels like the modern movement, and I'll take Sweetens Cove out of this when we talk about that in a second, but it feels like the modern movement toward the shorter courses is to try to create some semblance of a family-friendly course, and not necessarily as much about trying to be an architectural splendor. Am I wrong in thinking that, or does it seem like the modern movement is more geared toward family friendliness and time constraints than maybe space considerations or some other issues?
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right on that. And I think the poster golf course for this whole movement is going to be what's called Nine Grand in Cleveland, Texas, outside of Houston. That's under construction right now. It's a Mike Nuzzo golf course, and it's going to be nine holes. It's going to be a short nine-hole golf course to go with it, and a putting green. The idea is to make it entertaining. It's part of a real estate development. So the idea is to get it's something for people, to draw people to that real estate development. Is you don't have to. You can go with your kids and enjoy the putting course, and then maybe go play the very short par three course. And then if you move up and you want to go play the nine-hole course, I think plays from, I want to say 1,500 yards to 3,500 yards. So it's really this incremental steps of going from learning the game by just punting to being able to play what would be a 7,000-yard golf course. And the other thing that they did is within the routing are shorter routings. So if you get there on a quiet afternoon or a quiet evening and you want to go play four holes, you can do that as well. And I think that's going to be the modern kind of example of what nine-hole golf courses are going to be, because they're going to be part of a larger entity, and that's an entertainment area, you know, a family-friendly entertainment area. We can go and putt with the kids. We can go play a par three course with the kids. We can go play four holes on a regulation golf course with the kids, where they're playing from 15. Where they're playing par threes that are 70 yards, while you know mom's playing it from 150 alongside dad. You know what I mean? It's really interesting, and I'm really looking forward to seeing it when it opens.
I kind of get the sense that we have had these ideas for a while about, you know, in golf, okay, we need to accommodate people's time, we need to be more family friendly. Those things have changed. You don't just have only men going away for 6 hours and coming back
right,
up on a weekend anymore. That's not who we are anymore. So we need to create venues that are more family friendly, and they have a variety of options for kids, experienced players, total amateurs, and everything, you know, every type of player. We need to be a little bit of everything. But the problem with having a good idea in golf is that you actually then have to move earth or acquire land or make alterations to some space to be able to make that happen. So in terms of where we are with the concept of creating family-friendly spaces, like you're talking about with Nine Grand, where are we in the implementation part of that? Are we just starting? Are we far enough along that maybe I don't realize it? Or where are we?
I think we're in the infancy. I still think you're going to have a hard time selling nine-hole golf courses to the majority of people. I think why the nine grand concept is going to work in Cleveland is that real estate are for families. The houses are, you know, people coming in who are going to have children. I don't think the majority of people yet are ready to grasp nine-hole golf courses. And I think I think part of the reason for that is the way the golf media covers nine-hole golf courses. I mean, the fact that there wasn't a nine-hole golf course in anybody's top 100 rankings until the Dunes Club came along is baffling to me. And the fact is, the only reason the Dunes Club got that notoriety is because Mike Kaiser built it. If I had built that golf course and it was the exact same thing, it wouldn't have been on anybody's top 100 list. And Raiders were looking – I mean, I live in Connecticut. People are driving past Whitensville Golf Club, which I think is the best nine-hole golf course in North America by far, to get to garbage golf courses that offer no fun, no challenge, don't have good architecture. They've been driving past Whitensville since it opened in 25. And when you hear announcers talk about if they're going to go to TPC Boston and cover the PGA Tour, and they happen to mention golf courses they played in the area, do you think any of them are going to go to Whitensville? Not in a million years. Ben Crenshaw did, because Ben Crenshaw is that kind of guy. When the U.S. Open was when the Ryder Cup was at the Country Club, he went to Whitensville specifically to see the ninth hole there, and specifically to see that golf course, but specifically the ninth hole. But you think those guys are going to go there? Not in a million years.
So let's spin forward a little bit then to the number two course on your list, which is Sweetens Cove Golf Club, not too far from Chattanooga, Tennessee, and South Pittsburgh. I feel like that course has kind of been a watershed moment in terms of, maybe this is just my golf Twitter bubble, but I feel like the discussion around Sweetens Cove and what it could mean to golf architecture and the way we play golf and consume golf has been really important. Am I overstating that, or is it finally time that people recognize, hey, you know, nine-hole courses can be really spectacular and mean a lot of things for golf and can be done in a way that maybe makes it a little bit easier for people to create them and get people started in playing the game?
I want to be optimistic and think that Sweetens Cove is going to change the way everything's going, but I'm not sure this isn't a discussion between – you know, you and me and your listeners, we're the 0.1% of people that care about things like Sweetens Cove, that would get in our car to go see Sweetens Cove or any of the other courses in my book. You know, never mind that it's a nine-hole golf course. That's a spectacular design. And what Rob Collins and Tad King did out there is amazing. The strategy and the options and all that. I think it's a direct link to the National Golf Club. I think he's borrowed right from, I think he would say this too, I mean, I'm not making this up, you know, on my own, from McDonald. It's huge fairways with no rough, and there's 19 options on how to play the hole. And it depends on your skill level and the wind and where the flag is and how bold you are and, you know, how far you hit it and all that. So it's a great golf course. I hope it changes everything. The problem that Sweetens has is where it is.
Yeah.
The average person isn't going to go there because it's not on the way to or from someplace. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like to change.
Yeah.
It's the same thing with this restoration at Culver Academies. I mean, unless you're going to Notre Dame and you want to drive 35 miles south to go see this golf course, Culver should shake the world as much as because of his restoration. I mean, this was a golf course that was lying almost fallow. You know, and you go to Culver and you're like, oh my God, this is an unbelievable golf course.
And almost on the opposite end of that. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, finish your point.
And I was going to say, that's great, and I wish this would change the world too. But again, it's not. Most people, they're going to be us. We're going to be like, okay, I'm within 1,000 miles of this golf course. I'm going to detour because I need to go see it. And we're going to be glad that we did. But the average person isn't going there. I have a friend who's got season tickets to Notre Dame games, and he's an avid golfer. And I told him to go to his golf course, and he was like, all right, if I get a chance, I'll go. And he didn't go this year. You know, yeah. He went to half the home games, but you and I would have missed the football game to go see this golf course. You know what I mean? And so I'm skewered. The way I see the world, and I think the way you see the world, and probably most of your listeners see the world, is we're the people who are going to get in the car and go see Culver. And I would hope that Culver and Sweetin changes the world and proves to people that nine-hole golf courses are awesome. You know what I mean? They're fantastic. It's a Langford Moreau golf course. It's fantastic.
I feel like on the opposite end of Sweetin's is Winter Park in Florida. I finally got to play there during the PGA Merchandise Show week, and I'd heard about what Keith Fred had done and Riley Johns had done, and I hadn't seen any pictures of it and just was blown away because you're in the middle of a town. You're sitting on history. I mean, the place was opened in 1914, and just the intelligence it took to make a small space feel so open and offer so much variety, it's special. And I'm wondering if that can't be a model for urban golf moving forward, as we live in a culture now where you either live in the country or you live in a city, and there's not really a whole lot in between. You're either in a metropolitan area or you're not. Can Winter Park be instructive for municipalities, for city governments, city councils? Hey, we can make a modest investment in our golf courses that have been open 50, 60, 70 years and really are nothing to speak of. But if we put a good architect at a reasonable price who's hungry to do a good thing on this project, they could transform it and make it a centerpiece for why people come to our town. Because I honestly would not go to Winter Park, Florida otherwise, but I'm going to go back next time and I'm in Orlando to go play that golf course.
Right, and it's that concept too. You know, Winter Park breaks every rule. You know, you cross what, six streets to play there. You can hit a train on two holes. There's no rough on the golf course. It's 2,400 yards from the back tees, and it's spectacular. It's a blast to play. There's options and there's different angles, and the greens have a lot of movement, but they're not too fast. I think you're right. I think here's a good example for municipalities. Hey, maybe you take your crappy 18-hole golf course and turn it into a really good 9-hole golf course with the land, then have a little par 3 course next to it and a putting green or even a driving range, because that's a moneymaker. Driving ranges are moneymakers. Yeah. That being said, I think what municipalities have to do and in this downturn because golf has changed is they've got to start looking at golf courses the way they look at tennis courts and tracks and basketball courts. They don't ask those properties to make money. They have to stop asking golf courses to decide, this is the deciding factor. We have to get rid of this golf course. It's not making money. Well, that makes no sense. Because now I need you to get rid of the baseball fields too, okay? So what you need to do is, I don't want it to lose money. I don't want it to be gouging out a municipality. But why don't we approach it that way? Why don't we make really good nine holes that will be cheaper to take care of? We won't have to have such a big staff. We won't meticulously maintain it. Winter Park's greens have got to be rolling at what, 8.5 or 9? But they're perfect because of that undulation. The average golfer isn't going to get destroyed by the movement on those greens. They would if they were 11. But if the municipalities can approach it as this is part of the recreation, you know, concept that we want for our municipality. We want them to enjoy roller skating and swimming and running and softball and tennis, and golf's part of it. It doesn't need to make money. We don't want to lose money, but we don't need to fund the rest of the park and rec department off of golf. That shouldn't be the deciding factor. And Winter Park, with its popularity, seems like it's going to make money, which is even better. No, that's awesome.
Yeah, even better. I mean, I feel like for a municipality,
it's affordable. It's getting people to the game as well. It's very affordable to play, and that's great.
I think what's the max? $19 during peak season if you don't live in the area or something like that. I mean, that and a $7 replay rate. So for $26, you can go around twice.
Right.
And that's incredible value.
And it's an unbelievably, even though you're in a town, it's a really nice, relaxing walk. You're in these neighborhoods. You know, I mean, it's a blast. And like you said, the most you're going to pay is $26 for 18 holes. I mean, come on. That's fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. That's unbelievable. And I think that Winter Park can also potentially be a stake in the ground for a variety of different types. I mean, we could expand this out to 18-hole courses, so I'm going to kind of throw this theory out there, but I feel like when golf expanded so much and built all these courses, and so many of them were mistakenly developed around housing developments because developers thought people wanted to live on a golf course even if they didn't play golf. Those things are going away. So what we're left with are high-end country clubs and resorts that cost either way too much money to get in or way too much for the average person to go do. And then you have all of these kind of low-end courses that they may always just be cheap golf courses. But then you've got this big middle of courses that are okay, but if you do something with them, if you put money back into them and you don't just let them wither away, you have the opportunity to do what Winter Park did or do what other places are doing in revitalizing their golf offering. Is that, should that more focus on making offering better less, meaning like we were just talking about a better nine holes of a municipal course or a better nine holes of a local public course, and then have that revenue component of a driving range that maybe has Top Tracer on it or something like that? Is that the potential wave of the future for our sport, is kind of a combination driving range, great nine hole facility?
I mean, and let's do this. Let's not even work with nine holes. Why don't we do 12 great holes and a driving range mm-hmm. and a great little short game area, right? A three hole short game area, whatever works.
Yeah.
Will it go this way? I don't know. I mean, there's much more talk about it, which is, which makes me feel optimistic that maybe maybe the tide is turning. Wouldn't it be awesome if you saw some of these situations where there's these kind of mundane, poorly maintained 18-hole golf courses that gets turned into a 9-hole or an 11 or a 12-hole golf course? They put some money into it. The maintenance budget's lower, so you're the same, but you're doing it for 12 holes. It looks better. It plays better. People come out there. It's affordable. You know, again, and it's fun. That's the word that when people ask me about what we need to do to grow the game, I really think it comes down to that. It's fun. We have to prove to people that golf is fun.
I think you're right. And I feel like that part of that is also an education about architecture. Because the way I try to explain it to somebody who doesn't care about architecture is, when's the last time you played a golf course where you remembered all the holes? Not what you scored on the holes. Every golfer can remember that and tell a really boring story about it. But can you remember features of golf holes from every hole that you played, or most of them? And if the answer is no, then you're not playing someplace where you're getting the best possible golf experience. So what can we do to make, not make, that seems forced,